KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In that moment where I made the hole in the tent, I was so afraid that all the snow comes to me and I can no more breathe.
They can handle physical play, they can handle a fast pace, we've shown we can handle a slow pace, you know, and not get frustrated, you know, we've been able to adapt man or zone.
They are really good. Everyone talks about they're overrated. Have they been tested? Forget about it. They've got a legitimate front court, as good a front court as there is in the country.
Sports analysts talking about Gonzaga University, number one seed for the Final Four, for the March Madness. They'll make it to the Final Four, Andy. I know they will. Also, Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner, who talking about an avalanche coming down on her while she was camping. She's National Geographic Explorer of the Year for bagging a number of peaks. But we're going to start remembering Booth Gardner. He was Washington's 19th governor. He served from 85 to 93. He was also Pierce County's first elected executive, deputy trade, U.S. trade representative as well, and a leading voice for Washington Initiative 1000, the Death with Dignity Law. Booth Gardner died Friday night in Tacoma at his home from complications from Parkinson's. He was 76. In reading the comments from people all through this weekend, I'm sure you noticed that what mattered to many people and must have mattered to Booth Gardner himself was that he was seen as a decent guy, a nice guy, who, as the News Tribune wrote, the nice guy who finished first. Ron Dotsauer ran Booth Gardner's 1984 campaign for governor. Ron Dotsauer, thanks for talking to us.
You betcha.
What was that initial conversation like between you and Booth Gardner? Why did he want to run? Why did he talk to you?
Well, you know, first off, I had just come off running Scoop Jackson's, what turned out to be his last Senate race in 1982. And as you may be aware, he passed away in September of 1983. And so I was just in the process of shutting down the senator's offices around the state. And what happened was a couple things. One, there was a number of Scoop Jackson folks, including his former chief of staff, and all kinds of folks that wanted this guy from Pierce County to be the next governor. And I didn't know who the heck they were talking about, actually. I'd never met the gentleman. So a number of lobbying calls came into me and said, look, you know, this guy can be governor, but he needs you to run his race, which sounded awful silly to me to begin with. But I started hearing about him and his success as this county exec. And he had, you know, he also had enormous wealth. So a meeting was arranged between him and me and to have dinner at his home in Tacoma. And I was somewhat of a reluctant guy because I just didn't want to do another campaign. So, but anyway, I had dinner with Booth Gardner in 1983, late 1983, early November. And I just said, you know, this guy is special. He's unique. He doesn't really like politics, which I thought that was in my opinion, that was something that was very special, because if you really like what it takes to win, I'm not sure that you could be as successful an office holder. So great conversation, and I felt like, you know, I needed to do one more campaign. So by the end of 1983, Booth and I had gone to work, and we knew that the task was going to be daunting because Jim McDermott had been the Democratic nominee the previous 4 years and had upset an incumbent Democrat in a primary to win it. We had an incumbent Republican to beat, so it was not going to be an easy task.
Well, how much of a factor was his wealth in helping you get that campaign going?
Well, it was very helpful. Not only, you know, the help we got from a number of people, a lot of his relatives, frankly, and without that early money, we wouldn't have been able to get up on the air and do the early television. And, you know, we started out with Booth Gardner having 9% name ID, even though he'd been the Pierce County exec, and that was the second largest county in the state, he still only had 9% name ID statewide. So we had a long ways to go. So one of the things we did early on was, we did an early flight of media in the spring of 1984 that changed the direction of the campaign and gathered the momentum, and we won the primary handily, and we ran ahead of the incumbent governor in the primary when we had the blanket primary system, and the strategy was always to win the election in the primary, which is exactly what we did.
How did he like that campaign slogan, Booth Who?
Well, the better question is, how do you like the campaign? And he didn't. he was a very reluctant campaigner. I remember numbers of times. One story in particular is that he'd had this one of those days where I think I had him out at 12 different events in one day. And he didn't much like that. So that evening when he came into my office, he had his blazer on. And he walked into my office and he pulled his blazer all the way open, right? And inside the blazer was stickers of all 12 events. You see what you've done to me today? And there was all the stickers of every one of those events. Or the time when I had a former state patrolman who was driving Booth called me. We didn't have cell phones then. And he said, Booth won't get out of the car. He doesn't want to go to the next event. Or there were the times when he didn't want to prepare for his first debate. And Jim McDermott took him to school on that first debate because he didn't want to do debate prep. So all kinds of little things that indicated he didn't much like this whole business of campaigning. He often said to me, if I could just apply for this job, I've got a perfect resume to be the governor. And if I could apply, I'd know I'd get the job. So that was sort of his attitude towards the whole business of campaigning.
But I was struck by this, Ron Dotzler, in the Seattle Times article about Booth Gardner. You were quoted as saying, so he didn't like asking people to help him. He spent too much of his life helping other people. He thought that was an imposition. But you had organized events where he could mingle. He was a good schmoozer in that sense. What was that about?
He was not only good, he was the best. He's the best I've ever seen, even to this day. Of all these years of being around politicians, there was nobody that was a better retail politician than Booth Gardner, because he had such an incredible memory for names, and he could walk into the room and just by dint of his style and personality, he could own the room. But he did not. He was very reluctant to get on the phone and ask for money or ask for help, because in part he spent so much of his life giving. And he didn't, the concept of asking people, he was always surprised every time somebody said that they would be willing to do this or do that for him. He said, will they do that for me? I remember he had that little big question in his mark, because that just wasn't the way he operated.
So Ron Dotzler, here was among the things said in the obituary about Booth Gardner, in the remembrances of Booth Gardner.
Yeah.
That he had mixed success as a governor, no backroom head knocker. This is the News Tribune. And he watched some of his good government proposals, such as merit-based evaluations of state employees, got shredded by hard-edged lawmakers and union leaders, and that he maybe could have achieved more in his second term if he had been more of a, or for his legacy, if he had been more of a street fighter. What's your reaction to that?
Well, he did. I'll tell you that my reaction is a story that Senator Patty Murray told me on Saturday morning. Okay, and she said she'd just been a newly elected state senator, and she was on the floor, and the request came down that the governor wanted to see her. This was Booth Gardner, and so being a nervous, very junior, newly elected, newly minted state senator, she said, "What does the governor want with me?" So she wanders down, gets down to the governor's office, and she's meeting there in the governor's office with just Booth and herself. And Booth says to her, Patty, you've got this legislation here, and she didn't even remember what the legislation was in particular. She said, I've got this legislation in front of me, and I assume you want me to sign it. And she said, yes, Governor, I would really be very appreciative of that if you would please sign my legislation. He said, well, that's great, but I have this other piece of legislation that I need some help on. Are you willing to step up and help me a little bit? Okay. So it wasn't that Booth wasn't willing to mix it up. It didn't come natural to him, but he did a fair amount of that.
Well, he got a lot accomplished. When you look at the accomplishments that he got, and when you think about where we are today, running start, he was, and of course, he did have a good economy. Running start, the Growth Management Act, the first basic health plan, and First Steps, which is a program that helps low-income pregnant women. So you could look at his legacy and seeing that he did get something accomplished that he intended to accomplish. Did he get accomplished? Have you ever talked to him since? Did he get accomplished what he had hoped to accomplish? Did he feel he laid down the foundation?
Well, you know, I think that Booth would, if he were in having this conversation with you right now, he would say, no, I didn't get everything done I would have liked to have gotten done. But he did, as you just articulated, get a number of things accomplished. I think one of the things that he really got accomplished that we've lost today, unfortunately, is what I call civility in politics. And the governor really understood that if you were going to get things done, you needed to not be engaged in partisan polemics and vitriolic language. His style was of a calm demeanor and a relationship with people to get things accomplished for the public. And unfortunately, that is not the case today. And for those 8 years that he served as governor, and beyond that, when he was involved with all the other things that he used to say to me, look, I've been able to do as many things successfully since I've been governor than when I was governor, because he remained engaged, but the same sort of style and the same persona that he brought to the table as governor, he accomplished as a private citizen. So I think he brought that civility to the body politic, and I'm afraid that we're sorely missing that today.
Well, all right, sir. I appreciate you taking the time this morning.
You're very welcome.
Ron Dotsauer is co-founder and CEO of Strategies 360. It's a PR and public policy firm. He ran Booth Gardner's 1984 gubernatorial campaign. Booth Gardner was Washington's 19th governor. He passed away Friday night at his home from complications from Parkinson's. This is Weekday.
#917. A Seattle nonprofit is in India trying to save teenage girls from prostitution and child marriage by increasing their economic value to their families. More about that in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Eye Institute at Harborview Medical Center. The UW Medicine Eye Institute offers complete services from basic eye exams to complex treatments and surgeries. More information is available at uwmedicine.org.
43 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Chance of showers through the morning, then partly sunny this afternoon. Continuing chance of showers and an afternoon high of 50. Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner is the first woman to scale all 8,000-meter peaks in the world without the use of supplementary oxygen. We're going to talk with her in about 25 minutes or so.
That nonprofit, the Seattle nonprofit Landesa, is in India and the Philippines and China, around much of the world, trying to save teenage girls by giving them more economic value, by giving their families something that is tangible, ownership of land. Melissa Allen is the Seattle Times business reporter. She was able to travel and do a report on the Seattle nonprofit Landesa and the man behind it, Roy Prosterman. It was in yesterday's paper and this morning's paper and online, since we are an online world. Melissa Allen, good to talk to you. That story you did yesterday allowed the reporting from that allowed you were allowed to travel to other parts of the world to see what was going on. Can you describe the people you ran into that are benefiting from Landesa in India?
Yeah, there were sort of two sets of people. One were the families who've received land from Landesa over the years, which is the main thing that it does, and then the other group of people were the girls, the teenage girls, who in this pilot program in India, they're teaching how to garden so that they can hopefully increase their value to their families and not be given away in marriage or possibly prostitution.
One of the girls you talked to was doing a good job in her gardening, but her father didn't seem to think so.
It was amazing because you know, she would list all the things she does every day. She's not in school. She's taking care of her four younger siblings, doing most of the cooking, cleaning, and now the gardening, and yet he said she does nothing.
She sits around all day. What was she growing?
Oh, my gosh. She had a big garden. She had bottle gourds, which are really popular to eat there, pumpkins. She likes to eat the pumpkins and the leaves of the pumpkins, bay leaves. Oh, my gosh. She had just rows and rows of things, spices and vegetables.
And the land that she was farming, what was that land before she started gardening it, I should say?
Well, that's what's interesting. The families that we met often farmed on large fields. They either leased the fields or, in most cases, were farming for somebody else and just doing day labor. But with this pilot program, Landessa is teaching the girls to garden, basically. It's not really farming. It's just gardening on a small plot of land around their homes, and they're showing them how much can be done on that small plot of land. They can feed an entire family and then have some left over to sell at market.
You also talked to, I don't know if I'm saying the name right, Shanti Kungor and Ratna, a microplot in West Bengal. So how big is that microplot? In the paper, you said a tennis court with the green, with all that area, with the edges as well.
Right. It's not just the tennis court that you play on, but if you include the green edges, that's about the size of the plot of land that Landessa has found they can give people and still make a big difference in their lives. They've done studies, you know, internal studies on how much land a family would need to make a difference, and that's about the size. So on that land, they'll have room for a kitchen, room for sleeping, you know, one single room for sleeping, and then usually kind of a shed for their cows and an outhouse.
You know, Landessa formerly known as the Rural Development Institute. It's an interest to the Seattle Times and you, Melissa Allison, and all of us, because it's from here. It's a homegrown nonprofit. And Roy Prosterman, a UW law professor, he is the person who started it in the 60s. What was his vision?
He had just arrived in Seattle as a law professor at the UW, and a student brought to him a paper, you know, a law review article that was making a case for some Latin American country to go way back in their land records and prove that the land actually belonged to the poor families, and then they could steal it from the people who owned it now and give it to those poor families. And he read that and said that he thought, that's a really bad idea. You know, you're going to get a civil war, at least a lot of violence out of that. A better thing to do would be just to pay these landowners a market rate for their land, give it to the poor people. Everybody then has some land, and nobody has any grievances. And that's what he set out to do. The USAID, this was during the Vietnam War, the USAID in Washington had some people who thought that that would be a good idea, and so they hired him to go to South Vietnam and try the program out there during the war, and he did. He read through their land records and their land laws and interviewed peasants and came up with a way to do that in South Vietnam. And before the communists took over, USAID said that it was working very well. Rice production was up and Viet Cong recruiting was down.
Now, you know, you brought this up in the articles in the paper this morning and online last night. Prosterman was criticized and has been criticized because people said, look, what you're really doing is working in collusion with the worst forces in some governments to root out the rural land reformers, and they end up getting killed. And I remember talking to him one time, and I reading in your article as well, that really makes him mad, that charge.
It does, and it's not just some governments they're talking about. It's our government. They're saying that he goes to these countries sort of in parallel with our military, and while he's working on his land project, the military is sort of, in a way, following him around and figuring out who's leading these rural groups and then sometimes killing them.
Well, how does he have, all right, I mean, and you could probably, if it's not causality, there probably are some people who see connections there. Anybody ever have any causality, any proof in those when you looked into it?
Well, I traced it as far as I could, including emailing Bruce Franklin about it, and I don't remember if it was him or someone else who'd accused Mr. Prosterman of that, but nobody had any proof. Everyone just kept pointing to other articles, and then and they didn't lead anywhere. They didn't have any proof in them. There were I guess the longest argument I read about it was part of an academic an article that basically just said what I just said. You know, these things were happening at the same time, and they think that's proof.
You know, he's working in China right now, even though he's ostensibly retired and from a one-person operation. And this is 120 people around the world. What's his concern in China, and what is Landessa accomplishing there?
It's interesting. He says that the Chinese government invited him and Landessa to come look at their land reform projects and see if they were working, and when they're not, or you know, in the areas where they're not, to try to help them make it work. So what he's been pushing for in China for years is to get really long-term. You know, you're not going to get land ownership there, so it's going to be really long-term leases, and they've accomplished that in a lot of areas. And then also he's working mostly with the central government, so to then start working with the more local governments to try to ensure that corruption isn't going to mess with the land reform program.
Of course, that's what's happening in China is corruption. Right?
Yeah.
People get pushed off their land because somebody wants to build something, and they'll make a lot of money on it, and the ownership is very hard to track down. I was wondering, you looked at Landessa, 120 employees, half in Seattle, in India, the rest in India, China, Africa. They bring in about $9.1 million. They get funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Skoll Foundation. They get funding from a foundation that also helped fund the reporting that you're doing. Mm-hmm. What is it about land reform or land purchases that is such an anathema to so many people who encounter Landessa's efforts on the ground?
That's what I kept wondering about, too. It seems like the people, I think that in general, people in power, including wealthy landowners, don't want their land to be taken away. I think that's what it comes down to. For example, in Pakistan, I had that quote from someone who commented on one of Roy Prosterman's articles in an English language website there. And the guy was like, look, if I own land, I'm not giving it up. And I think that might be what it comes down to. They're afraid of giving poor people any of their power.
Even if they're paid for it.
Yeah, even if they're paid for it. I'm not sure that the money is enough for them. They're afraid of giving up the power that would come with the land. And I think it seems that it's very short-sighted because things change, you know, and power structures change. And if you have that many poor people not doing well, it seems like you're sort of courting trouble. But they don't see it that way.
Talk a little bit about this pilot program again in India, the Nike Foundation, teaching teenage girls about their rights, showing them how to garden, also can get them in trouble with their families because they see that they have more rights than they're treated to. How has it been gaining traction in some of those villages? Could you tell?
You know, it's interesting that you'd bring that up because I think that even though in the girls' groups I sat in on, they were very, the people leading the groups were very direct about, look, these are your rights. This is illegal. You know, child marriage is illegal. Rape is illegal. Abuse, other forms of abuse. They really had quite a list at times. They were very straightforward about it, but it seems like when the girls go back to their families to talk to their parents about it, and maybe Landessa is teaching them exactly how to couch it. I did not see this, but they seem to be bringing it up in a way that's not antagonistic with their parents, so that they're just saying, hey, you know, I learned about this, and look at what my garden is doing, and do you think maybe this could make a difference in your decision? So that the parents are still allowing their girls to go to these programs. And in one girl's case, Mamata, the lead in the story, her father, you know, the one who said that she's doing nothing, is letting her be a leader. She's one of the leaders of this girls' group. So she goes every week, and she's trained to teach other girls how to garden and learn about their rights.
Well, Melissa Allison, you're the Seattle Times business reporter, and this story is also about what a big and growing part of our economy, which is the NGO economy, because of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, because of the growth through them and others of groups like Landesa. What's the larger view you see happening with Landesa, with the Gates Foundation as well, in terms of how they're approaching trying to achieve their success through, I guess we could call it some market efforts, as opposed to how things have been done somewhat in the past?
Well, that's interesting. Well, a couple of things seem to be changing, and I'm not an expert in the nonprofit world. This is one of the first stories I've ever written about a nonprofit, but it seems from reporting this story that, for one thing, I mean, of course, what Landesa does is completely capitalistic. It's about the free markets and giving people money for what they own and trying to avoid conflict and violence in that way. The other way that these nonprofits seem to be changing, which I thought was so interesting, is that a lot of times you'll have an NGO go into a country and say, okay, we're going to dig wells or we're going to build schools or something else that's very, very useful and valid and has wide-reaching, it affects a lot of people. But they seem, even those that are digging the wells and building the schools, seem to be adding this policy, you know, trying to affect the laws of certain countries or at least the policies of certain countries, or if not countries, then regions, to have an even broader impact. And that's what Landesa has done all along. They've looked at the laws and looked at entire countries or entire states or provinces within countries to try to have a really huge impact. So they've sort of come at it from the opposite, so that this girls program that I wrote about in some ways is them heading toward what the other NGOs have been doing, on the ground. Okay, here's a program where we're actually going to, you know, reach individual people one at a time.
Yeah, that's right. That's very interesting. Rule of law and ownership. How mm-hmm. interesting. Melissa Allison, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You can read both parts of Melissa Allison's articles, special reports about the Seattle-based nonprofit Landesa and the profile of Roy Prosterman, who started that group, at seattletimes.com. This is Weekday. Now March Madness. Bookended by the Super Bowl, Major League Baseball's opening day. It's one of the most watched sporting events in the country. Men's college basketball tournament known as March Madness. And Spokane's Gonzaga University given a number one seed, first time in the school's history. So what are their prospects? You know, sometimes we're the Seattle Times radio outlet, and that's what we are this morning. Bud Withers covers college basketball for the Seattle Times. Bud Withers, thanks for taking the time.
You bet, Steve. Glad to be with you.
Glad to be talking to you. All right, so Gonzaga ends up as the number one seed. This was somewhat expected, but fully expected?
Well, not fully. I think it was probably better than a 50-50 proposition. It appeared that it came down to Gonzaga and University of Miami, which, of course, has had a great season in the ACC, won the ACC regular season and the postseason tournament. So it had a lot of chops, but Gonzaga aced out Miami for the last number one seed, I guess.
Why are they so good? What are they doing in basketball this year that's put them so high up the rankings?
You're speaking of Miami or
no, Gonzaga? I'm sorry.
Well, they're very balanced. They can hurt you in a lot of ways. Got good sophomore guards who have now played, who have now started for two seasons. So you're talking about probably 65 games between the two of them, Gary Bell Jr. and Kevin Pangos. But the big surprise this year has been Kelly Olynyk, who's a Canadian from British Columbia, who had two fairly frustrating seasons as a 7-footer who didn't do much as a freshman and sophomore and kind of came to a crossroads before his junior year and considered transferring, et cetera, decided not to do it. And there was kind of a logjam of big men in front of him. and they mutually decided he would redshirt, sit out the season his third year, and he had a very productive junior or redshirt season, third season. Came back this year just a completely changed player, much stronger, much more agile, much better balance, and he's going to be a first-team All-American. So he's really been the big catalyst this year.
You know, John Feinstein writing in the Washington Post, the headline for his story was, Gonzaga gets the number one seed and an arduous path. Who are they facing right off?
Well, their first round opponent is Southern University, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Obviously, you'd expect them to get past them. It's a region of sort of half court physical teams. They would play in the second or the what's now called the third round. It'd be the second game. They would play the winner of the Pittsburgh-Wichita State game. Both of them. Very much half-court teams, not run up and down the floor type teams. Pittsburgh, of course, from the Big East, and has long been playing a real physical half-court style. And then, if you get past that, then you likely would have to play a team like Wisconsin, which is also very much half-court and runs kind of a unique offense and very good defensive team that doesn't turn the ball over. So. It could be a real grinder if they're going to go a long way. They don't appear to be facing a lot of teams that are going to be tremendously athletic, but they're really going to be tested on the boards and inside and weather and toughness, frankly.
Yeah, you wrote about that.
Right.
This is a toughness and that if other you quoted guys saying if anybody wants to challenge them, they have to be as tough as Gonzaga. What is that? How does that reveal itself on the court that Gonzaga is tough and can play tough?
Well, usually it's, I guess, two metrics. Usually it's just in how well you defend and how well you get up into people and how well you execute your defense with defensive rotations and defensive help on players that are trying to get to the basket, things like that, and as well rebounding. Usually, that's kind of the number one metric. Are you hanging in on the boards? Are you giving up a lot of offensive rebounds? That sort of thing. So, I think this Gonzaga team is pretty well equipped to do that. Though they're very versatile. They've been a team that can run when they need to run. That's traditionally kind of what they've done over there, but they've also been a program that very much believes in big guys and the fact that you, if you're going to go a long way at this level, you need big guys that can score inside and defend inside. So I think they're versatile enough that if they execute those things, they can make a big run.
I like this phrase you use, Bud Withers. It all looks rugged more than racehorse.
Right. It's sometimes in the past, for instance, the Illinois game this year, which was one of Gonzaga's two losses. They're vulnerable to perimeter quickness, to guards that can either get into the lane and get over Gonzaga's backcourt, which is not terribly tall. They're basically a couple of 6'1" guys, 6 foot or 6'1" guys, or backcourts that can really shoot the ball and win with athleticism. And it doesn't appear that there's a lot of that in this region. It's more of a front court half court style they're going to be facing.
Say, how about the people who are putting this team together? What kind of respect should we be showing the coaches and the staff at Gonzaga to be able to get this team up and so high up the rankings?
Well, it's got to be considerable, Steve. It's been a long, long process. They've done it brick by brick. They've been to 15 NCAA tournaments in a row. and which is a really remarkable accomplishment, exceeded only by three real blue blood programs in the country. They've done it piece by piece, and this year has kind of been the culmination of all their work over the past 15 years, and even before that, when they were not going to the NCAA tournament, but beginning to kind of gear up and schedule tougher and recruit better and so forth. But it's a pretty remarkable accomplishment for a small Jesuit school in Spokane.
It's a good year for Jesuits.
It is.
Bud Withers covers college basketball for the Seattle Times. All right, so just a few questions. Which teams got snubbed from the tournament?
Well, there was a guy very familiar to State of Washington people, Tony Bennett from Virginia. They were just wildly inconsistent this year and finished with a bad loss in the ACC tournament. They're going to the NIT. Tennessee was another one. They lost to Alabama in the SEC tournament the other day. Really needed to go farther than that. Let's see what else. In the Big 12, Baylor played a really tough schedule with a young team, but was really flighty and inconsistent. And I don't know that there was any big question that they would make it. I think it was kind of assumed that they wouldn't. Those were some of the key ones.
That's interesting. Even I have heard of Baylor. What about the first round matchups? Are you most looking forward to any particular games?
Well, there's a ton of them out there. There's I don't know about first round so much as what we might see down the road. I mean, you could have in Salt Lake City, you could have an Arizona team meeting New Mexico, which would be a matchup of six versus number three seed in New Mexico. And of course, those are going way back. Those are two old foes from the Western Athletic Conference before Arizona joined the Pac-10. And then what we know now is the Pac-12. That could be a really interesting game. The 8-9 games are always pretty intriguing, just by definition. You've got Colorado State against Missouri in the Midwest region, which could be pretty fun. You've got a situation also in the Midwest, playing in San Jose. You've got Oregon as a 12 seed playing Oklahoma State, and I would think Oregon has a real shot in that game. It's a really, really low seed for Oregon as a team that won the Pac-12 tournament. That seems to be eliciting maybe the biggest surprise of all the things the committee did, the basketball committee did in setting this bracket. But there are games across the board that are really going to be intriguing and relative toss-ups all over the bracket.
Yeah, a lot of games, a lot of games to be played. Tell me something, Bud Withers. Should a Cougar fan or a Husky fan just buckle down and root for Gonzaga because we're all from Washington State?
I know it's tough for a lot of them. Yeah, you'd like to think they would, but of course there's a lot of old rivalry ties there that would prevent people from jumping in and doing that. But yeah, I mean you'd like to think people would be big-hearted enough to do that.
All right, Bud Withers, I appreciate you taking the time.
All right, Steve, my pleasure.
Mine too. Bud Withers covers college basketball for the Seattle Times. Stay with us.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone. So is Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and take me to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. Cause it's basketball of Mr. Curtis Blow.
Mr. Curtis Blow. Well, in a minute here, we go from the basketball court to the tops of the world's tallest mountains with National Geographic's 2012 Explorer of the Year. That's just ahead.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at snoqualmietribe.com.
India is developing rapidly, and much of that growth is fueled by one of the dirtiest energy sources, coal. A new study shows that pollution from coal-fired power plants is killing up to 115,000 Indians every year. Much more about that tonight at 10 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from College Planning Solutions, an education partner in college admissions since 1992, located in Bellevue. A seminar about finding a student's desired choice for college is on April 2nd. More online at collegeplanning.com.
44 degrees in Seattle with scattered showers across the region. Forecast says showers likely through the morning. Then a chance of showers this afternoon, and it should turn partly sunny with an afternoon high of 50. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:45. A look at the week ahead in state politics in 20 minutes.
Mountaineer Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner became the first woman to summit all 14 of the world's 8,000-meter peaks without supplemental oxygen or a porter, 2011. The goal was achieved not without costs. Her 2010 attempt to summit K2, her last peak, ended with her good friend and partner slipped and fell to his death. A year later, she tried again and was rewarded with a view like she says she'd never imagined. She is the 2012 National Geographic Explorer of the Year. She joins us to talk about her work. She'll be talking about her work as well. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for coming.
Why did you want to do this?
Because I love the mountains. I love the very high mountains. To be in such a great nature, I really appreciate a lot.
You're from Austria?
Yes, I'm from Austria.
You could have just stayed home and done it there.
Yes, that's right. We have quite a lot of beautiful mountains, but the mountains in Austria are not so high. The highest one is Großglockner with almost 4,000 meters, and the 8,000 meter peaks is just another dimension.
What was the first 8,000 meter peak you attempted?
My first 8,000-meter peak was in 1998, Joyu, based on the Nepali-Chinese border, Tibetan border.
Was it the first time you were in that country?
Yes, it was my first time to be in Tibet. I had another attempt in Pakistan before in 1994 on Broad Peak, but I didn't reach the main summit. So my first real 8,000-meter peak was Joyu. Fantastic.
Did you decide to do this on your own? Was it your choice?
Of course, it was my choice. I think things like this, mountaineering, you can really do only if you want to do it. If you have this inside your heart, in your mind, that's the most important. It was my own choice.
Yeah, you have to get your head wrapped around something very real, very strenuous. How do you train?
I do a lot of endurance training. Almost quite every day in the morning, I start with long running, or I ride on my mountain bike. In the afternoon, I go for rock climbing. So I do a lot of endurance training. In winter, ski touring, ice climbing. In summer, rock climbing, mountain biking, hiking, running to the mountains. And after 6-7 days, I have a break, a rest day, and then I start again. It's my profession now.
It is your profession.
Yeah.
You go without oxygen. How do you train for that?
To climb without bottled oxygen, you cannot really train. The most important is that I do a very accurate acclimatizing to give the body time to adapt to the low oxygen pressure. This is the only thing I can do. And of course, I drink a lot to keep the blood liquid in high altitude. It's very, very important. It means 4 to 5 to 6 liters of liquid every day. And so I feel quite comfortable.
Will you describe that ascent on K2, how did it start out when you first began? How did that begin, that climb?
You mean in 2011 or already before?
No, the last one.
The last one.
I mean, you had had this trauma. You'd lost a friend. You'd had a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You had to decide if you were going back.
Yeah.
You decided to go back.
Yeah. In the beginning, I felt that I want to have distance from K2, but after some months, I felt that I have to go back. K2 was always in my mind, and I wanted to go to another side, no more to the south side, to the Pakistani side. I wanted to learn about the North Pillar, the Chinese side of K2. It was a big dream to approach by camels through the Shakskam Valley, very beautiful, a very remote area. And then if you see the North Pillar of K2, it's just amazing. Such a beautiful direct route up to the summit, and this became my big dream to climb this route.
Is it easier, that route?
No, it's more difficult than the route on the south side. But there was something who stayed in my heart, in my mind. I thought if I really prepare very carefully and very accurate, maybe we can manage it. I knew that a very strong team is important. We were a small team, only six climbers. But I believe that somehow we can climb up. And I think the most important is to have this confidence in your mind also. So we trained really a lot. We were very well prepared, and then we started.
But confidence is critical, isn't it, for this? Confidence is the most important thing?
For me, it's almost the most important thing to have the confidence to be able to climb up and down again. Yeah. And with all my preparation, I got this confidence. I knew that I was very well prepared, and if we are lucky, the weather is good, we can do it.
Gelindi Kaltenbrunner is the first woman to scale all 8,000-plus meter peaks in the world without the use of supplementary oxygen. She's National Geographic Explorer of the Year in 2012, and she's speaking tonight and tomorrow night. As part of National Geographic Live, Ben Arroyo Hall, Seattle Symphony, bringing you her talk and her photographs. When it says you went up without a porter, what does that mean? You carried your own pack.
Exactly.
That's not always the case with climbing?
Many climbers use the help of high-altitude porters, but from the very beginning, it was in my mind that I want to climb without bottled oxygen and without help of high porter. I want really climb just with my own energy. So I carry all my stuff by myself. No help for establish the tents. Of course, help from the teammates, but not from high altitude porters.
Why?
For me, it's a very nice style of climbing. It's a pure style of climbing for me. It's just my personal idea. Everybody can do how he like, but for me, it's so important to do it by my own energy. And for example, if you use bottled oxygen at a height of 8,000 meter, it's like you are on at 6,200 meter, for example. So I would prefer to climb a smaller mountain by my own energy as a high mountain with artificial help.
Do you want to go onto the highest mountains? You know, Everest.
I have been on Everest.
Of course.
In 2010, and I was so lucky.
Right. All of them, that's right. What am I saying?
Yeah. I was really lucky with the weather, with everything, but... On Everest, I would not go again because without bottled oxygen is really quite a little bit risky.
Coming down?
Coming down in a safe way, yeah.
Yeah? What happened? I mean, what do you recall?
You know, at 8,000 meters, there is only one-third of oxygen pressure left. And for the body, it's really risky to stay up there. And you have to listen very carefully into your body to feel if everything works in the right way. And you have to keep your concentration all the time very high. And only a small mistake means that you never come back. And so I managed it in a safe way, but I think now I would not turn back.
Are you on the mountains longer because you're acclimating?
You mean...
More time? Than a person who would use oxygen?
Yes, I have to do a longer acclimatization than people who use supplemental oxygen.
At a higher elevation?
Yeah.
How much longer?
It depends. Maybe two and a half weeks longer altogether.
At the highest elevations?
Not at the highest elevation. For example, on Everest, I have spent 3 nights at the height of 7,600 meters. Then I came down again to base camp, and then I tried to climb up the summit. And a person who uses supplemental oxygen does not need to climb to 7,600 before. They climb once or twice up to 7,000, then they turn back, and then they start for the summit.
What do you do for all that time up at that height on a mountain like K2 or Everest? What do you do?
There's a lot to do. you know, many hours I spend for melting snow. To get 1 liter of liquid, you need quite a lot of time. So when I reach a place where I establish my tent, I start immediately the cooker, and hours per hours I melt snow. And then there's a lot to observe. We stay in such a beautiful nature, surrounded by many beautiful mountains, and so you can look for hours. And of course, we prepare for the next day. We have to prepare our crampons and our stuff. We try to keep the boots dry. And so there's a lot to do up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Little video recorders?
No. No.
Singing songs around the campfire?
No.
It's serious stuff up there.
It's really...
It's life and death.
Yeah, it's really serious up there. We have to collect ice, for example. It needs quite a long time. We are really focused on things that we stay quite comfortable. It's not really comfortable, but to stay in a safe way, that's the most important. And we have to carry all by our own, so there is no space for a book or a video recorder or whatever.
So because it is life and death, because there have been tragedies, when you are at the summit, what's the memory you carry of those people who didn't make it? I mean, how do you keep yourself keeping their memory alive when you make it?
Especially on K2, Frederick, our Swedish friend who died in 2010 on the south side, we kept always in our mind. We spoke a lot about him because each of us know him very well. And we kept him in our heart, in our mind, in a very positive way. And of course, many times he was very close, and especially when I did the last steps to the highest point of K2, he was very, very strong in my mind. Quite a lot of other friends who I lost in the mountains. And, you know, they are no more with us, but in our mind, in our heart, they will remain forever.
What's your next goal?
My next goal is to go to Alaska together with my husband, Ralph. He's my favorite climbing mate also. And we would like to try a nice route on the south face of Denali. Mm-hmm. It's a big dream of mine since many years, and now I would like to go there.
An ice route?
Yes, an ice route.
Harder?
We will see which route we choose, but it will be quite a challenging route, I think.
Galinda Kaltenbrunner will be speaking about her climbing. K2, Danger and Desire on the Savage Mountain, tonight and tomorrow night at the Benaroya Hall. Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation. Thank you very much.
And now, the sound of the day.
Sometimes ordinary sounds are very comforting, like this sound of making French toast breakfast on the weekend while listening to Morning Edition. We had a weekday listener send that in to us. What's your sound, comforting or otherwise? Record 30 seconds and send it to us. Sound of the day in the subject line and email it to weekday at kuow.org. Stick around, more weekday to come. Happy eating.
French toast. Have you heard of the so-called sharing economy? It's a personal exchange of goods and services, like couch surfing, or the Finney Ridge Tool Library, or even sharing your dog. How well does it work, and what can happen when it goes wrong? We're going to take that up later today. Right now, if you...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.